Namane. Namaste Saraswati Deve Gauravari Pacharane Nirvishesha Shunyavari Paschachare Sutarane Umangyanam Timurandasya Ganamjana Shalakaya Chakshur Miritam Jainam Tasmai Sri Gurave Namaha. So I'm offering my obeisances unto Srila Prabhupada, who so kindly opened my eyes with the torchlight of knowledge while I was standing in the midst of darkest ignorance. Well, this evening, Bhakta Bill has selected for discussion from the 11th chapter of Bhagavad Gita, which is called The Universal Form, and this is text number 54 with a gigantic purport. So first we'll chant text 54, which is up there, huh? No? In translation. My dear Arjuna, only by undivided devotional service can I be understood as I am, standing before you, and can thus be seen directly. Only in this way can you enter into the mysteries of my understanding. So I'll read Srila Prabhupada's purport, but we'll take it piece by piece, read a little bit, talk about it, and see how far we get. This is a very important verse in the Bhagavad Gita, and it also occurs in an interesting place in the Bhagavad Gita. And I think all that will come up as we go through this purport. So he's used this word, bhaktya. Bhakti is devotional service. So bhaktya means by means of devotional service. Two means but. This is a carryover from the previous verse, as we'll see. So, ananyaya. Ananyaya means without being mixed with anything else. Sheer devotional service, or pure devotional service, as Prabhupada says in the word for word, without any tinge of speculative knowledge or fruitive activity. So, pure devotional service. Shakya, is it possible, aham, can I be seen, evam dida, like this. Here at this point Krishna is appearing before Arjuna in what has been described previously as his manusham rupam, his form which appears like that form of an ordinary human being, two-armed form. Because there's been a sequence of forms displayed in this point, and it ends in this two-armed form. So when he says evam dida, like this, he means this two-armed form. And he says then here, in this way, it is possible, jnatum, these are all infinitives in Sanskrit, jnatum, to know me, drastum, to see me, and tatvena praveshtum, and to enter into the understanding of me. Tatvena means in truth. The Prabhupada says, enter into the mysteries of my understanding. Purport, Krishna can be understood only by the process of undivided devotional service. He explicitly explains this in this verse so that unauthorized commentators who try to understand Bhagavad Gita by the speculative process will know that they are simply wasting their time. Prabhupada many times refers to unauthorized commentators. You might think that's a little confrontational or a hostile. As a matter of fact, it is interesting to note that if you go to the university and take a Hinduism course, you'll have a Bhagavad Gita which is translated and often commented upon by somebody who got a PhD in Hinduism from the University of Chicago or some godforsaken place like that. And they'll translate this verse, and they'll explain Krishna to you, and yet are not devotees. Now, they don't pretend to be devotees. They don't think it's necessary to be devotees. And yet they'll doesn't stop them. So this is what's meant by unauthorized commentators. And most of us, our first exposure to the Bhagavad Gita was by some unauthorized commentator in this way. Maybe a competent translation from, sometimes far from competent translation, sometimes competent translations, but still, when they come to explain Krishna, they miss the point. And especially in this 11th chapter, the point is missed. Because in this 11th chapter, Krishna has shown Arjuna his psychedelic universal form. This is a spectacular display of transcendental pyrotechnics. What this is a kind of outside view of the Supersoul. There's a sense in which the whole universe is the single body of God, and God ensouls the universe as the Supersoul. And so every part of the universe is situated in the body of God. And so really the whole universe can be harmonized and coordinated in purposeful activity just like we can be. So you can see the entire universe moving like a single, highly intelligent, highly purposeful, highly intentional organism. So when the universal soul is, when the universal form is seen, that's what you see. What Arjuna saw was, is described as sitting in one place in one time. He was at a specific geographical place in India, at Kurukshetra, and it was a particular time. And then, by Krishna's permission, he was able to see in that one place in one time, all time in one in all space. And it appeared as though he saw a gigantic being with thousands of heads, arms, belly, legs, moving together. This is famous in the Bhagavad. In one sense, it's the dramatic climax of the Bhagavad Gita, and it knocks your socks off when you see it. Arjuna's description is he became terrified. His hair stood on end, started to shake uncontrollably. This incredible display of power and majesty and magnificence. And he was terrified. He began to shake and sweat and grovel before this display of Krishna. So this universal form has become famous, even in, there's a famous book by a German theologian named Rudolf Otto called Das Heilige, or Der Heilige, I forgot the, what is masculine, but Heilige, the Holy. I think it's translated in English as the idea of the Holy, in which Otto tries to establish, and this book must have been written in the second decade of the century, I think, tries to establish the holy as an objective ontological category. In other words, by that time, 19th century mechanistic materialism had wanted to reduce religion to just matter. And Otto at least wanted to say, no, by what the Germans call Religionswissenschaft, the scientific study of religion, still we can see that there's something objectively out there to which a religious person is responding. And he said that is the holy. And so he does a kind of cross-cultural phenomenological analysis of the appearance of the holy. I think one is Moses on Mount Sinai in front of the burning bush, and the other is a universal form. It's been a long time since I read that book, but the other is the universal form. And so the experience of the holy, according to Otto, has various features that you see everywhere. The holy appears to something is the entirely other, something that stands opposite to us, and in one sense is very alien or different, but is compelling, full of mystery, fascinating. But it also instills in us a feeling of creatureliness, which he, Otto, then says this is the root of the idea of sin, that when there's the experience of this holy, you feel small and little and tiny and insignificant and like nothing in front of this. Anyway, he goes on like this. And this is, you know, it's supposed to be the matrix from which all religion develops, this encounter with the holy, which is then garbed in various cultural decorations and dress and, you know, called Krishna here or whatever. But anyway, he went to this universal form in the Bhagavad Gita for the at least emotional impact of this experience. I just describe it. Let me read it to you. He wants to see how you have entered into this cosmic manifestation. Krishna says, "See now my opulence is hundreds of thousands of very divine and multicolored forms." I said this is very psychedelic, huh? All the demigods in one body. Whatever you wish to see, behold at once in this body of mine. Everything, moving and unmoving, is here completely in one place. And what you now see and what you may want to see in the future. So he displayed his universal form. Arjuna saw in that universal form unlimited mouths, unlimited eyes, unlimited wonderful visions. The form was decorated with many celestial ornaments and bore many divine upraised weapons. He wore celestial garlands and garments, and many divine scents were smeared over his body. So there's an olfactory component to this. It's not just visual. All was wondrous, brilliant, unlimited, all-expanding effect. Hundred thousands of suns were to rise at once into the sky. Their radiance might resemble the effulgence of the Supreme Person in that universal form. Oh, another this became famous is when the first atomic bomb was blown off in Los Alamos. Oppenheimer quoted from this passage. Time I am the destroyer of the worlds, and I've come. So this atom bomb reminded him of the universal form. So it's very attractive. Those people like material scientists who are worshippers of power. They like this universal form. So this is already famous. Huh? So here it describes in that universal form the unlimited expansions of the universe situated in one place, although divided into many, many thousands. That's what he was able to see, this kind of remarkable condensation of space and time into this single form. Then here's Arjuna's reaction, bewildered and astonished, his hair standing on end. Arjuna bowed his head and offered obeisances with folded hands and began to pray. So he describes the form, no beginning, middle, and end, radiant like innumerable suns and so on. Uh, on seeing this wondrous and terrible form, all the planetary systems are perturbed. He sees, then he sees all the demigods offering prayers and saying swasti, 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 and entering into that form. Swasti means like peace, peace, peace. So then he becomes bewildered, and what he sees then in that form is which is particularly to the point, is he sees the battle that's about to take place, and the battle becomes manifest. Although we would see a battle as two groups of soldiers clashing on a battlefield, when Arjuna sees the coming battle in the universal form, he sees that form manifest a very ferocious faces with teeth and fire coming out of the mouth, and then all the soldiers in the battlefield being devoured and crushed in the mouth of that form. In other words, Krishna's doing it. That's what he sees. It's a vision of the future that he sees. So that's the universal form. After Arjuna is sufficiently terrorized by this vision of the form, then he requests Krishna to please remove, I don't want to see it anymore. And he asked him to see his two-handed form, his four-handed form of Vishnu, and then finally his two-handed form of Krishna. And it's here that we understand when he says, those words are there, evam vidaha, like this, when I am seen like this, Krishna is referring to the two-handed manusham rupam, human-like form, only by pure devotional service. What he has said, actually, if you look at the previous verse, naham vedaya, na tapasa, na danena, na cheshyaya, shakyam eva vido drastum dristavan asti mam yata. The repetition of na, 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 not by the study of the Vedas, nor by penances, nor by charity, nor by worship is it possible to see me like this, the way you are seeing me now. And then bhaktya twa, that's the but only by devotional service can you see me in this way. So this is where this comes. Not by this, not by study of the Vedas, not by austerity, not by what is it, worship, not by charity, but only by devotional service can I be seen. In other words, this form of Krishna with his two-handed forms, not all this psychedelic display, but just the form of Krishna is more rare and elevated and harder to attain than this universal form. This is what the unauthorized commentators do not care to understand. They're all gawking at the universal form because it's Hollywood. You might sound like a little flip, but Hare Krishna. But Prabhupada, in his purport, describes, I have a good basis for being like this. Prabhupada says in his purport, he calls the universal form a godless display of opulences. So when I first read this Bhagavad Gita, that was the, you know, I'd read several different versions of Bhagavad Gita. Maybe this was the fourth translation I'd ever read. And I was stunned to see Prabhupada refer to the universal form as a godless display of opulences. And then in the subsequent part of this chapter, as he will in this purport, show how it's not really important. It was not meant for Arjuna. It destroyed Arjuna's feelings, more intimate feelings for Krishna, and therefore it was not that important. Godless display of opulences. So by Hollywood, I mean, you know, its special effects. is very good. God is very good at special effects, and we all like that. You know how Moses goes up the mountain. We all saw that movie. Late night show. I saw it in the first run. Charlton Heston goes up there, and you know there's thunder and lightning and all those special effects. Everybody knows when God appears, there's all kinds of special effects. Just to let you know, it's God, right? So when we find out that the most confidential revelation or display of God is Krishna, who's notable for lack of, there are special effects, but they're not crude and garish. It's not the godless display of opulence. It's very hard to, there are quite interesting special effects. For example, Krishna has a garland that he wears all the time. And around those garlands are little bumblebees all the time. And when you get close to Krishna and you hear those bees, you discover they're all chanting Vedic hymns. The buzz is not just a buzz. They're all chanting Vedic hymns. But anyway, that's more subtle. But there are lots of interesting features to Krishna, that's for sure. As I said, this universal form is the dramatic center of the Gita, because it ultimately, in the previous chapter, 10th chapter, Arjuna has already said to Krishna, "I accept you as the Supreme Personality of Godhead, and now I will do everything that you say." That's really the conclusion, in a sense. Arjuna didn't want to fight in this war for very natural reasons. It was a nasty civil war. Those were his relatives, teacher, everybody on the other side. He learned that Krishna was saying, "I want you to fight in this war. I want you to do it for my sake, as a matter of duty, without attachment to the results. And if you fight in this war in this way, you will not incur in any way sinful reaction, because it's my order that you fight in this war." Because Krishna had a mission. And this is another thing people don't understand about the Bhagavad Gita. It occurs in context. It's within the Mahabharata. And there's a history leading up to it. And Krishna's mission, as he describes in the Bhagavad Gita, "When I come, my business is that I establish those who are pious and good, and I vanquish those who are evil." This is Krishna's historic mission. And in these days, things were more black and white. This was 5,000 years ago. Now you want to establish the pious and annihilate the miscreants. You can't tell them from each other. They're all confused, you know, what we like to call in the university moral ambiguity. But at the time that Krishna came, that's why Lord Chaitanya is the avatar for moral ambiguity. because in everyone's heart, the good and the bad are both there. There aren't very starkly good people and very starkly bad people. But we all have a little good, and we all have a dose of nastiness. And by chanting the Hare Krishna mantra, then the heart becomes cleansed. So Krishna's mission in this age is, when he has to destroy what is demonic, is to destroy the demonic mentality, but not the people that have it, because the people that have it, if you destroyed everybody that was demonic, there wouldn't be anyone left to save. But in 5,000 years ago, things were different circumstances, and things were quite polarized. There were devoted people, and there were demonic people. And at that time, Krishna, as part of Krishna's descent, he played the role of a kshatriya, a king. which is the same thing as a military commander, and led armies on the field on the side of the Pandavas, who were the devoted people against the Kurus. So as part of his mission, he had gathered together on this battlefield in one time, in one place, by his will, all the people he had to annihilate, and then wanted this battle to take place. All this big arrangement to get them there, and then he's ready to accomplish his mission. He says to Arjuna, okay, let's fight. He says, no, I don't think I have scruples. This is God. He's the highest authority. He's made this arrangement. And Arjuna has scruples. Of course, it should also be understood, people, that if Krishna is absolute, so ultimately he has no friends and he has no enemies. He's the same to everyone. But because he's also an absolute person, it appears that he loves and it appears that he hates. He has the devotees whom he embraces and he has the miscreants whom he destroys. But because he's the absolute person, there's no difference between his loving and his hating. So everyone who on the battle of Kurukshetra was killed was actually liberated. There were not, it was a great benefit. Prabhupada said at one point, if you want to hate, hate Krishna. He said if you have to hate, hate Krishna. If you become a really big demon, Krishna will come and personally kill you, and then you'll be liberated. So at any rate, at this time, Krishna appeared. He had made this arrangement. All the demons were there. The battle was about to take place. Arjuna has his scruples and his hesitations. So Krishna tries to explain to him what his position is, and what Krishna's position is. That he is the... And Arjuna accepts him. Param Brahma, Param Dhamma, Pavitram Paramam Bhavan. You are the Supreme Brahman. And so on. So then after that, Krishna shows universal form. Just if you're not convinced. And that universal form, he sees Krishna standing before him in his two-handed form, and then he shows him the universal form by which Krishna is acting as the soul of the universe. And he sees the whole universe as Krishna's body. And then he sees the battle taking place as the act of that one universal person. And it's described that he sees all the soldiers rushing into their mouths and being crushed. And he says, what does he say to Krishna then in that universal form? Who are you and what is your mission? And that's when he says, I am time, the destroyer of the worlds, and I am come to engage all people. Everyone but you, O Arjuna, on this battlefield will be slain. But, and that's what Oppenheimer quoted, Septim, different translation, I am death, the destroyer of the worlds. That's what he said when he saw this atom bomb go up. But what he's showing Arjuna, and then he says, these people in this battle, he said, they're already killed by me. Arjuna says, I have a moral dilemma. Shall I kill them or not? And Krishna's saying, they're already killed by me. I did it. It's a done deed. Yeah? You just be my instrument. That's what he showed him. So he saw this. You could say this is the dark side of God, huh? Time I am, the destroyer of the worlds, and I have come to engage all people. At least from a certain angle of vision, that's what it looks like. But Arjuna also saw that this was, in fact, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, who is all good, and he has his purpose. And you just be my instrument. But then he asked him, he says, I've seen this form, but my mind is disturbed with fear. Now, please, again, show me your the form of grace. I would like to see that. Show me your four-handed form. I long to see you in that form. And then Krishna showed him his four-handed form. Now, four-handed form of Krishna is called generally Narayan. This is the Supreme Lord who's full of opulences. Narayan is the form of the Lord as the majestic ruler of creation. Not as the universal form. He's aloof from the universe, situated in the spiritual world. But when he has his four-handed form of Narayan, there's always surrounded by opulence and lordship. It's called in Sanskrit Aishvarya, the quality of being the Lord. Lordship is very much there. So he saw that form of Narayan, his four-handed form, and then his two-handed form of Krishna, which is higher than, or more intimate than, the form of Narayan. This one Supreme Personality of Godhead, but he can show himself in multiple forms. It's the nature of people, that we're individual people, so we also have our different forms, so to speak, for our different roles we play or different relationships. And for many of them, we're encouraged to buy different outfits by which we may look quite different. You know, when we want to go running or playing tennis or some sports, you know, we have to dress up in the appropriate, you know, $1,000 worth of gear so we look right. And we kind of have a different language. And maybe we associate with different groups of people, and we speak in different ways. And then, you know, you take a shower and you go to work, and, you know, then there's a coat and tie and a suit, and you kind of put on a different personality for that. And you have a different set of manners that you follow, and different group of people you talk to. And then, so in this way, at home with your intimate friends, you're one way. In another way, with your, you know, spouse's relatives, you may be a different way. But these are just different facets of our personality that come out in different relationships. And so the Supreme Lord sustains so many different relationships. He has so many different situations. So, as Narayan, it's very obvious he's God. He's full of majesty, and power. Also, you feel small when you're with Narayan. It's like meeting the President of the United States. It does something to you. I don't know if you've ever seen this phenomena up close. I've not seen it with the President of the United States, but I've seen it on a smaller scale. But you get somebody who sits around all day long and he badmouths, that Clinton, you know, I bet he was like, he had those bimbos, you know, and he'd go on and on. He'd talk about Clinton. That guy doesn't know what he's doing. And then, you know, somehow or other, Clinton walks into the door. And a guy stands up, and he's so, Mr. President, you know, and he's so respectful. And he's awed. You know, that's the President of the United States. And when you get in the presence of very powerful people, you feel it. You feel scared, and all of a sudden you can't speak very well. Your old stutter comes back. You start to thin film of sweat pops out on your forehead, and then he goes, and you say, "Gee whiz, wow! You know, I was really the president of the United States. It's weird, but that's how it works, right?" It always does that. Even though, you know, you were so nasty a few minutes before. God has a similar effect, only much more so. Because, I mean, the President of the United States is really a nobody compared to the Lord of the Universe. Who doesn't even have to stand for election. So there's great awe and reverence when there's with God. And actually, Clinton is actually, or whoever, is actually an ordinary guy who's been artificially inflated. We all know that. And he gets some of the attributes of God, and we try to cut them down as much as possible, because in a democracy we can't stand it that we've made anybody a leader. But he is. He's an ordinary person who somehow, rather by good fortune or whatever, has attained this position. But actually, when it comes to God, actually he is God. What we hold against people like Clinton or others is they think they're something they're not. In fact, they act like they're God. But when it comes to God, he is God. He actually is. You can't say, you know, when he says, "I'm the Lord," you can't say you're on an ego trip, because that's what he is. So he naturally is in that position. Of course, that makes people angry too, and that they want to say there is no God and something like that. It's an offense to the principles of democracy or something. That's another story. But actually, he's quite a powerful presence, the Lord. And anyone who comes into his association, they feel immediately small and insignificant and overawed and a thin film of sweat. But actually, because he's attractive, at the same time, people are very, very happy and overjoyed to be in the presence of the Lord. But even so, there's always this formality and distance. He is very great and I'm very small. So the significance of Krishna is that when the Lord wishes to get rid of that distance that separates him from his devotees, that his opulence and majesty naturally inspires, is he causes the devotees to forget that he's God. With Arjuna, for example, he's had a fraternal relationship. They used to wrestle with each other. They used to fool around together. Here Arjuna, in one sense, he knows that Krishna is God. He's just seen the universal form. But he wants to see Krishna again as Krishna, because he has a much more intimate love for him. So he knows that Krishna is God, but he doesn't care. It's more important that he's Krishna. So it's said that as Narayan, the Lord's opulence overwhelms his beauty. But as Krishna, his beauty or his sweetness, madhurya, overwhelms his opulence. Well, that's why as Krishna, there's this closeness that's not available. When the Lord reveals himself to us as Krishna, we are now invited to participate in the private life of God. With Narayan, it's a public official. It's the difference between Mr. Clinton and Bill or whatever. That's the difference. And that's why Krishna is here. He's saying to Krishna, Krishna's saying to him, now you cannot see this form of mine by any amount of charity or penance or worship or austerity, but by pure devotional service, then it's possible to see me in this way. So, but people who are not devotees will not be able to understand this. They think somehow or other that gee whiz, special effects, universal form, that's the real thing, because it knocks you over and all those other stuff. They won't be able to appreciate Krishna. And Prabhupada says, no one can understand Krishna or how he came from parents in a four-handed form. He did. He was originally manifest in a four-handed form and at once changed himself into a two-handed form. These things are very difficult to understand by study of the Vedas or by philosophical speculation. After all, it's God. I mean, what can you understand by ordinary philosophical speculation about this runty little material world? Practically nothing. Very difficult to understand. You can get a book by E.O. Wilson that's this thick about ants, and he's just touched the surface of the subject by his own admission. This many pages on the world's greatest expert on ants is at Harvard University. His whole life has been studying ants, and he's just beginning to understand them. Now we turn to God. And E.O. Wilson's a very smart man. We're not all so smart. And he will spend many, many lifetimes exhausting the subject matter of ants. He will. This is what you, well, I would guess that he would become an ant. That's one way to study ants, of course, is to become an ant. And then maybe you can alternate lifetimes. One lifetime an ant, the next lifetime a professor of ants, then an ant, then a professor of ants, back and forth. And then you can go on to the next subject. To understand even the material world by the empirical method of gathering knowledge is not possible. And they want to speak of understanding the